Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to our conference. Second day. I only have one very brief announcement to make. It's to do with speakers who have consented to having their talks recorded in order to be podcast. Can you remember to fill in a form and leave it with Sophie in the registration desk? If you don't have form, she has more forms to give you. So, just that. Otherwise, we are ready for our second keynote by Gisèle Sapiro. Gisèle Sapiro is professor of sociology at the School of Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences, and she's research director at the CNRS in Paris. She is a specialist on the works and thought of Pierre Bourdieu, has worked on the sociology of literature, intellectual history, translation, transnational literary relations and exchanges, globalizations, and of course, cosmopolitanism. Her monographs include La Guerre des Écrivains, which was translated into English as The French Writer's War and published by Duke University Press in 2014, which tackled the difficult question of the state of the French literary field during the Nazi occupation in the Second World War. La Responsabilité de l'Écrivain, published in 2011, is an analysis of literary trials in order to investigate the representation of social responsibility of writers in the public sphere from the 19th century to the present. Most recently, in 2014, she published La Sociologie de la Littérature. Amongst several edited volumes, I would just like to signal some that are particularly relevant to our topic today, L'espace intellectuel en Europe, about the sociology of intellectual space in Europe from the 19th to the 21st century, and Translatio, on the market of translation in France in the time of globalization. She has been visiting professors in the United States, Germany, Canada, Israel, Spain, and Romania, amongst other places. Her books have been translated, and articles have been translated into various languages, including English, Spanish, Italian, Danish, Russian, Japanese, etc. She is a public intellectual, and she is a cosmopolitan, and that's why she's with us today. The title of her talk is The Transnational Literary Field Between Internationalism and Cosmopolitanism. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Stefano, for organizing this wonderful conference, and thanks to Clément and all the organizers of this conference. Transnational approaches have developed since the 1990s as a result of the criticism of methodological nationalism. However, the national perspective is opposed alternatively to the notions of international, transnational, global, world, cosmopolitan, without all these concepts always being rigorously defined and distinguished. I would like to start here by some preliminary definitions in order to distinguish the uses of this concept for the history and sociology of literature. As we shall see, the national is not necessarily opposed to all of them. Considering these definitions helps us take into account the actors that participate in the emergence and functioning of the literary field at the national and transnational levels. I am referring here to Bourdieu's field theory. Fields are relatively autonomous social spaces wherein the competition over symbolic capital occur according to specific criteria and specific rules of the game. For instance, the value of literary works cannot be reduced to political or economic criteria. However, this autonomy is always relative and may vary according to the external constraints, that is to say, the religious, political, economic, and social constraints. Here I shall question this constraint from a transnational perspective. So, preliminary definitions. The Latin concept of cosmopolitanism, which was rediscovered during the Renaissance, pre-existed to the establishment of the nation states as the main political organization. It designated initially world citizenship and was used by Kant in this sense to define three domains of the law: the jus civitatis, the national civil law, the jus gentium, which concerns the international relations between states, and the jus cosmopoliticum, which concerns the universal human state aiming at peace. More broadly, cosmopolitanism has come to designate the relation between the local and the universal, or between the domestic and the foreign, indicating an openness to other cultures. It was used in this sense by a sociologist like Georg Simmel. Cosmopolitan was also employed to designate central cities hosting immigrants and visitors from around the world, like Paris at the turn of the century. The cosmopolitanism of Paris was even more pronounced for the literary field, as argued by Pascal Casanova. A lot of immigrants and refugees were there. Vienne, Geneva, Brussels, as we heard yesterday, were also cosmopolitan cities, especially for literary, artistic and political life. The national is not necessarily opposed to cosmopolitanism, but nationalism definitely is. I shall keep the notion of international for interstate relations, for instance, international conventions like the Berne Convention on Literary Property, and for organizations and policies based on a representation of the nation states as such. The League of the Nations, founded in 1920, is such an international organization. The League had a committee for intellectual cooperation, and in 1924, an International Institute for Intellectual Cooperation was created in Paris. It was replaced after the Second World War by UNESCO, which is also an international organization. In this sense, internationalism is not opposed to nationalism. There are different kinds of international ideologies. The League of the Nations reflected the Wilsonian internationalism. UNESCO will promote a developmental internationalism against colonialism. This ideology is one of the forms political internationalism takes. These forms vary between an essentialist conception of the nation, there is a fascist international, there has been, and an instrumentalist and temporary one conception of the nation, the communist international. But this instrumentalist and temporary conception is also a factor of exchange and circulation of models and people. These two internationals had very concrete expressions in literary life. They organized conferences like the 1930 Congress in Kharkov or the fascist meeting in Malmö, Sweden in 1951. Between these two extremes, one must situate cultural alliances with sometimes essentialist connotations like pan-Germanism, pan-Latinism, and regional alliances based on geopolitical foundations like pan-Americanism and pan-Africanism. They can adopt forms that are more or less institutionalized. Whereas internationalism does not challenge the nation-state sovereignty, institutionalized regional alliances may lead to the transfer of part of the state's power to a supranational governing body, as the case of the European Union illustrates. ALENA would be another example, North American alliance. These supranational entities may play a role in literary life through subsidies to literary cooperation and to translation, like those offered by the Creative Europe Programme for Culture. For instance, there is now a call titled Support to Literary Translation Project. Regionalization is a current trend that has come to play a growing role in international relations and that interferes with bilateral agreements in a way that still waits to be analyzed. Transnational can designate organizations and fields that do not depend on nation states, such as the religious field. The concept of transnational is also well suited for informal networks or gatherings, like the avant-garde, for instance, the surrealist or situationist movements. And I shall also use the concept of transnational literary field because it can combine national, international, and transnational logics. The literary field has gained autonomy from the state and from the market, but this autonomy is only relative. The literary field partly depends on the state, which determines the limits of the freedom of expression, but also the author's social status with regards to social benefits and the kind of support they can expect. In authoritarian states, the counterpart of having a status as an author was to serve the regime by spreading its ideology. The Writers' Union in communist countries were official organizations which played a major role in the international exchanges within the communist bloc, and also with Western countries where such bodies existed, like the Comité National des Écrivains in France. In the same way, national societies of authors organized formal cultural exchanges. The literary field also depends on the market, whose logic is transnational. The book market is structured by the linguistic areas and by the states through taxes and customs, literary property, and again, limits of the freedom of speech. The linguistic areas are partly because of colonialism, transnational for some of the most important, that is to say the English, the French, the Spanish, the German, the Portuguese, the Arabic. However, the book market is also regulated by international conventions such as the Berne Convention adopted in 1886, or the more recent TRIPS Agreement, the trade-related aspects on intellectual property rights signed in 1994 by the World Trade Organization in order to circumvent the Berne Convention. It was especially the clause on moral rights that the United States wanted to circumvent. Globalization is originally an economic concept, which can be applied in a fruitful way to the book market. By the 1970s, it became a watchword for the opening of borders to the free circulation of goods, a dynamic that was driven by the United States via the GATT agreements. However, unlike the artistic field, for instance, the global circulation of books requires us to include the conditions of translinguistic exchanges within what has become a global market for translations. The use of the concept of globalization also interrogates the geographic borders of this market. Whereas, as we saw, the linguistic areas constitute markets where books can circulate without being translated if the political borders are open, the translation market that developed after 1850, it existed before, but it developed really after 1850, was mostly limited to Europe and the United States until the 1950s. Although these borders were extended since then, as we shall see, some areas like Africa are still excluded from these exchanges. The use of these notions needs thus to be historicized and contextualized in different social and political configurations. I shall distinguish here two periods, the period of internationalism running from the end of the 19th century to the Second World War, and I will develop more this part, and the period of globalization. Internationalism means that the nation states played a major role in literary exchanges and could foster or hinder cosmopolitanism. During the globalization period, the market logics became more dominant, and the cosmopolitan facade should not conceal the power relations and the unequal conditions of access to the transnational field. In both periods, the state and the market contributed to shape the transnational literary field, but their relative weight changed. I shall consider here factors that shape and condition the transnational literary field and that favor or hinder its unification. These factors are education, the book market, the nation state, political movements, specific authorities of the transnational field such as prizes. And these factors are imbricated, but I shall try to distinguish them and to establish their temporality, which can overlap. Until the end of the 18th century, the common cultural base of the European Republic of Letters was classical education. Latin was its lingua franca. In the 18th century, French became the language of culture for the European aristocracy. It was the language of the aristocratic cosmopolitanism. The national literary fields, starting with the German one, and also the Scottish one, were partly built against this elite cosmopolitanism, which was considered as superficial. The German intellectuals from the Sturm und Drang opposed Kultur und Bildung to the French civilisation, as argued by Norbert Elias. However, Goethe also theorized the concept of Weltliteratur. It included the classics, which should continue to serve as models, and the literatures in other languages, with which he considered that there should be exchanges. This can definitely be and has been regarded as a form of cosmopolitanism. While the European Republic of Letters was gaining autonomy from the religious field, the common classical heritage began disintegrating in the 19th century, along with the nationalization of culture and of education. But in reality, as a result of the significance of classical studies in secondary education, it continued to nourish literary culture until the middle of the 20th century. The consequences of this educational issue for literature have not yet been researched enough. For instance, one could ask to which extent the avant-garde, who rejected the tradition, had had or not this classical education. And there is a sociological work by Norbert Bandieu who shows that half of the Surrealists did not have. They took the modern program of education, which did not include the classical heritage. So they did not hold this scholastic capital. Indeed, the conditions of access to classical education was limited to small elite. In France, for instance, whereas the primary education was made compulsory for all children with the Third Republic in 1881, high school was paying until 1933. Around 1900, only 1% of the males of a class of age would get the baccalaureate. This access was also very limited for girls whose schools were separate and did not prepare for the baccalaureate before 1924. Note that the relation to classical texts also concerns writers from non-Western cultures, I mean the classics of their own culture, such as the Arab, Chinese, Japanese cultures. However, in these countries, modernization occurred through the importation of Western models. This process underlies what Franco Moretti has called the Jameson Law, after Frederick Jameson's analysis of Japanese and Indian novels as hybrids of Western forms and local realities. Quote, in cultures that belong to the periphery of the literary system, which means almost all cultures inside and outside Europe, the modern novel first arises not as an autonomous development, but as a compromise between a Western formal influence, usually French and English, or English, and local materials. In colonial countries, it was more an exportation than an importation, which occurred first through the channel of education. This education to the dominant culture and language produced literary works in French, English, German, but this production was marginalized in the word book market and even in the linguistic area because the colonized areas lacked publishers and booksellers and the literacy rates were still very low. However, this extension challenged the national borders of the national literary fields. For instance, in 1920, the Goncourt Prize was awarded to René Maran, a black writer who had denounced the colonial administration. This award provoked a scandal in the media. The conservative intellectuals contested the very possibility that a black author represent French literature. The spread of Western education through colonialism thus engendered a tension in the very definition of national literatures. For instance, as Tristan Le Perlier has shown, the notion of Algerian literature in the interwar period referred to production of the white pied noir and was considered as a regional literature. The nationalization of Algerian literature, and he speaks also of ethnicization of Algerian literature, started with the following generation in the 1940s and was achieved with the independence war. French still continued to be an official and literary language along with Arabic. Thus, the Algerian literary field is split between, on the one hand, the Francophone authors who are turned towards the Francophone area and market and also towards the French literary tradition and contemporary literary field. And on the second hand, the Arab-speaking authors who write in Arabic and are turned towards the centers of Arab language area, Cairo and Beirut. And referred to the Arabic tradition. And both groups, the two Algerian groups of writers are dominated in these two transnational fields, French and Arabic. No, it's not the... Something's wrong. I'm not sure that's the... Okay, well, thriving on folklorized reinterpretations of popular local traditions, the construction of national identities took place in a transnational process of circulation of a model from one country to another, as argued by Anne-Marie Thiès. The list of items that composed these identities included language, literature, typical paintings and musical works, and so on. This construction allowed dominated cultures to gain autonomy from dominant cultures, in particular from French culture. and resulted in the formation of an international space of competition between nation states defined upon a cultural, national and territorial basis, first at the European level, then on a global scale. The states played a significant role in this competition by introducing protectionist measures for national firms and the organized professions, and by providing financial support to the national cultural production and to its exportation abroad. For instance, in the interwar period, the fascist government eager to compete, the Italian fascist government eager to compete with the French and German cultural hegemony, actively supported the translation of Italian literature, mentioned by Francesca and other colleagues working on Francesca Biliani on this period. The construction of national identities entailed a nationalization of the literary field, which engendered cultural xenophobia and rejections of foreign elements that could compete with the national ones. But it also entailed the building of an international space, which was achieved in the interwar period with the creation of the League of the Nations. Embodying the Wilsonian political conception of internationalism, as already said, the League of the Nations conceived of cultural exchanges as a means to pacify the relationship between nations after the dramatic experience of the First World War. The League of the Nations created, as I said, an international committee on intellectual cooperation to promote international cultural exchanges between scientists, researchers, teachers, artists, and other intellectuals, which counted writers such as Thomas Mann and Paul Valéry. It embodied the new idea that culture should be part of international relations. However, the endeavor, in order to favor cosmopolitanism, did not prevent tensions and conflicts within this institute due to unequal power relations and rivalry between countries, especially between France and Great Britain, which competed over cultural hegemony. At the same moment, an autonomous international literary organization emerged, the Pen Club, created in 1921 in order to, quote, promote friendship and intellectual cooperation among writers everywhere, and also to emphasize the role of literature in the development of mutual understanding and world culture, and to fight for freedom of expression. The competition and struggle over hegemony also underscored the building of supranational cultural identities. For instance, pan-Latinism against pan-Germanism. In France, the movement in favor of Latinity was led by reactionary and Germanophobic French writers who gathered in the Monarchist League Action Française in 1908 around two writers, Charles Maurras and Léon Daudet. They defined Latinity as the basis of Western civilization, while German culture was seen as the product of Byzantine influence and, of course, also Jewish influence, thus a barbarian culture. Conversely, the German extreme right built a northern identity opposed to the southern cultures. So this type of supranational identity was opposed to cosmopolitanism. Beyond this internationalization process, which reinforced the nationalization of culture and from which entire regions around the world remained excluded, the nation states that were imposing legal and customs barriers were not drawing strict borders. On the one hand, the differentiation of national literary fields occurred, as already suggested, on the basis of a common culture, humanist culture, and the models imported were imported from dominant cultures. On the other hand, the logic of market expansion, the hegemonic ambitions, and colonialism are three factors that led to the formation of spaces of circulation and exchanges that extend beyond national borders. So I shall now focus on the book market. Beyond the common reference that classical writings provided, national language literatures were initially formed by translating works in order to construct a literary and editorial body of works in the national language, which was being codified, and also, as polysystem theory has shown, by importing stylistic models. For instance, literature in modern Hebrew For For instance, literature in modern Hebrew produced in Palestine in the first half of the 20th century drew its models from Russian literature. And it borrowed from French literature was mediated through Russian literature, through the Russian translations of French literature. Acknowledging the original Hebrew nature of national literatures should lead us to relativize the idea that cultural mestizage is uniquely a result of globalization. I mean, even the national identities were built out of mestizage. The emergence of these national publishing fields was tightly related to the nationalization of culture. The emergence of these national publishing fields was tightly related to the nationalization of education and to the democratization of the access to education. Translation became the main mode of circulation of text by the mid-19th century. In 1978, an international association, the Association Artistique et Littéraire Internationale, led by Victor Hugo, was created in order to unify and extend the laws on literary property to the world market for translations. This objective was accomplished by the Berne Convention, adopted in 1886, and joined by many countries at the beginning of the 20th century, excluding from this market the poor and or colonized areas who were condemned to plagiarism. For countries that just joined the convention, such as Brazil or Hungary, publishers had representatives whose mission was to detect plagiarism, as I found in the French publisher Gallimard's archives. Literary agents and translators acted as intermediaries on these markets. They often proposed to a publisher to represent the firm in a country. At the time, like when publishers wanted to acquire a work for translation, they were putting an option, reserving the exclusive right to, like in the outward, reserving the exclusive right to represent the work in the country for a limited period of time. Despite the multiplicity of actors on this competitive market, which as a factor of differentiation and heterogeneity from country to country, the progressive unification of this market was not only legal. The body of translated works proved often to be the same from one language to another. These works, written in the oldest literary languages, notably French, English, German, and Russian, became in this way word masterpieces. A word canon was thus formed from the very arrival of national literatures, and the canon continued to expand, largely as a result of opportunities for international recognition, such as the Nobel Prize, founded in 1901. Nobel Prize winners were translated into other languages. Works by Rabindranath Tagore, Thomas Mann, Sinclair Lewis, Ivan Bunin, and Luigi Pirandello were immediately translated into French and other languages, fostering the isomorphism of the translation segment of the national literary fields in the context of the cultural competition between European countries. However, there were still significant variations, and the reception of these works was different from place to place. In France, during the interwar period, in the context of intensified cultural exchanges, translation became organized in book series that were separated from French productions. One of the first series launched by Stock at the beginning of the 20th century was called Bibliothèque Cosmopolite, and renamed after the First World War, the Cabinet Cosmopolite. It published Thomas Mann, who won the Nobel Prize in 1929, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis, who won the Nobel Prize the following year, Maria Remarque, Pearl Book, Virginia Woolf, Catherine Mansfield, August Strindberg, Scott Fitzgerald. These series were sometimes subdivided according to the country of origin. National identities were indeed, along with genre, the main categories of classification in the upmarket sector. This was much less the case for popular literature that also circulated across countries. The prevalence of national identities was partly due to the intermediaries' linguistic skills. These intermediaries also produced anthologies and panoramas of foreign literature. So, for instance, the small publisher Kral Sagittaire published anthologies of American, German, and Spanish literatures, edited and introduced by critics specializing in these literatures. And also, De Noël and Steele launched a series of contemporary foreign novelists, which included volumes on American, Italian, and German novelists who were introduced to the French literary scene through this channel. Jonas would also dedicate special issues to foreign authors from a specific country or a language. However, if you look, for instance, at the catalogue of Gallimard in 1936, you can see that works were translated from European languages, apart from one from Bengali by Tagore, the winner of the 1913 Nobel Prize. These authorities contributed to the building of a transnational literary field and a new world canon, which would replace the Greek-Latin canon by the mid-20th century, as showed by Daniel Millot, authors like Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Horace, Plutarch, Seneca, Plautus, and Tacitus, who were among the 60 most translated authors at the beginning of 1930s, according to the Index Translationum, disappeared from this list after the Second World War, and Plato was the only one who survived. They were replaced by Tolstoy, Dickens, Dostoevsky, and Balzac, to quote only the most consistently on the list of the 30 most translated writers. However, as argued by Pascal Casanova, the power relations within the transnational literary field are unequal. Indeed, while the access to reading and writing was being democratized in many Western countries, the conditions of access to this world canon were unequal across countries. This can be attested by the Nobel Prize winners. It was not open to non-Western authors until the 1960s, Tagore excepted. Tagore's case was discussed yesterday by Elke Bommer. This opening of the world canon to non-Western authors was partly due to a program launched by UNESCO in the 1950s, supporting translation from non-Western cultures in order to catalyze literary interpenetration. This program encouraged editors and publishers to start translating classical and modern works from Asia and Latin America, expanding the borders of the world market of translations from Europe to the world, although whole areas like sub-Saharan Africa were and are still excluded again from this market. For instance, in France, at Gallimard, the sinologue René Etiamble created in 1953 a series titled Connaissance de l'Orient. Although communist China was not included in the UNESCO project, Etiamble persuaded the head of Gallimard that it was necessary to translate contemporary Chinese authors such as Lu Xun in order to attest to the literary revolution which had been taking place in the country since 40 years earlier. Oh no, that was a story. Sorry, I'll get back to this afterward. As Etiamble explained to Roger Caillois, who was in charge with the UNESCO program, in a letter dated July 5, 1953, Etiamble's purpose was to render accessible to the French educated public works, works of high literary quality that were never published in our language, or so badly translated that it's better not to talk about them, and chosen in order to illustrate the mores and cultural values in all the countries in question, India, China, and Japan to begin with, but I would like to include Persia and the Arab world. Neither the publisher nor myself are looking for immediate commercial success. We want to educate the public, to enlighten the Orient for them, but it goes without saying that we will have to, and at the beginning especially, offered them titles that encouraged them to educate themselves, novels that, while possibly entertaining them, inform them on people that are not familiar with. Most of the great novels from Asia are unknown in France. This letter emphasizes the pedagogic function ascribed to translation of upmarket foreign literatures, especially those issued from peripheral regions. The idea that literature can inform us about the cultures and mores of a country, which also underlies the teaching of foreign languages and civilization in France at least, but I think in other places as well, helps explain the rise of translations from certain peripheral languages. Despite the length and scope of the endeavor, the great Chinese novel Hong Liu Meng was 2,500 pages. So it was a huge work. So only 10 titles had been published in this series by 1960, but which was already something. If, as expected, the sales were modest, there were 1,189 copies on average, the series filled the gap in French culture and publishing and was thus highly praised by critics. And in 1968, the Japanese writer Yasunari Kawabata was awarded the Nobel Prize. It was also the period of the boom of Latin American writers, and three of them won the Nobel Prize. Miguel Angel Asturias in 67, Pablo Neruda in 71, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez in 82. But it was not before the year 2000 that a Chinese writer would be awarded this distinction. It's Gao Xingyan won it in 2000 and Mo Yan in 2012. And Naguib Mahfouz is the only Arab writer who won the Nobel Prize to date. It was in 1988, despite the rise of Arabic literature in translation since the 1990s. The opening of the transnational literary field to non-Western culture can be observed in Gallimard's main series for foreign literature du monde entier. Between 1950 and 1960, the number of languages represented in the series rose from 14 to 23, and the number of countries from 23 to 38. Although European languages are best represented, one can find during these years titles from Bengali, Hindi, Arabic, and Hebrew. By the end of the 1970s, new small independent publishers started investing in translation of peripheral languages and countries, an investment that boosted the competition around a linguistic diversity in translation. In, again, Gallimard's series Du Monde Entier, you can see a number of new languages that appeared during this period, and the number of languages will reach 40 in the globalization period between 1978 and 2010, including Chinese, Korean, Icelandic, Serbian, Slovenian, and the number of countries will reach 57, among which Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Libya, Venezuela, and Uruguay. The interest of Western publishers in these peripheral authors is a condition for their access to the transnational scene. And the most endowed with symbolic capital, like Gallimard, have also the highest consecration power. Being translated with Gallimard enhances one's chance to get a literary prize and to get translated into other languages. However, while and we could, of course, I could say the same thing for some English or American publishers. However, while it started including non-Western cultures, the access to international consecration was still not really open to minorities because of the unequal conditions of access to recognition in the national field. It is only since the 1990s that the awareness to minorities and diversity modified the jury's choice, as illustrated by the Nobel awarded the Nobel Award to Toni Morrison and Herta Müller. The consecration of postcolonial writers contributed to relativize national categories in the perception of literary works, whereas national and consequently international literary authorities tended to promote national authors, those who had been rooted for more than two generations in the country, resided in the cultural centers and were the middle or were from the middle or upper classes. A growing interest in writers formerly relegated to the margins because of their geographic or ethnic origins came to the fore around 1992. That year, the St. Lucian poet Derek Walcott was awarded the Nobel Prize. Sri Lankan-born Canadian novelist Michael Ondaatje, the Booker, and the Martinique-based Frenchman Patrick Chamoiseau, de Goncourt. However, beyond the specific strategy that they need to develop in order to get international attention, and that Graham Haggan has described as the postcolonial exotic, these writers have to be published by major Western publishers. Only those who are have a chance to get consecrated, like Wole Soyinka, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1986. So that the growing cosmopolitanism of the literary field conceals a high degree of centralization and concentration of the power of consecration in the central cities and in the hand of the most prestigious publishers. In 1993, the French government modified the conditions for supporting translation from the French to other languages. It was no more French authors, but authors writing in French that could get support. So no more nationality, but language. This opening of the cultural policy reflected the evolution of the French editorial production. If you look at the nationalities of the authors whose books were translated in English in the US and published in the US between 1990 and 2003, you observe a very high diversity, more than 30 nationalities, including authors from former colonies. So you can interrogate the very notion of French literature, which should be certainly replaced by literature in French, but still it's defined as French literature and exported as French literature. In fact, it's literature in French published by French publishers, publishers located in France, because they will not promote authors that are published in Africa. Finally, whereas women had access to writing more than other professions which were closed to them in the first half of the 19th century, only five women were awarded the Nobel Prize until the 1990s. Seven won it since then. The access to international consecration reflected the situation in the national literary fields. It was not until after World War II that a woman was awarded the Goncourt Prize. The winner was Elsa Triolet, a Jewish, an immigrant from the Soviet Union, and a communist, though she did not have her communist party card. She was Aragon's wife. That was in 1945, the same year that women obtained the right to vote in France. Marguerite Yourcenar was the first woman to enter the Académie Française. That happened in 1982. The year after, Léopold Sédar Senghor was the first black author to be co-opted at the Académie Française. These two elections should also be related to the political context of the accession of the access of the Socialist Party to the government in France. To give a hint of the unequal conditions of circulation of literary works according to gender, I should just mention that only one out of five of the works translated in English, literary works translated in English in the US in the 1990s were written by women. Of course, if you separate the classics from the contemporary, then the picture changes a bit and you have one third. But until now, I didn't have figures about the representation of women in the French contemporary literary field, but now we have some figures. So it's not about works, but about female authors. They're represented around 40% of the authors in the 1990s, and now they are like something like more than 50%. So this certainly is, they are certainly underrepresented in the circulation, all the more considering that the United States is the most, and the English market are the most open and interested in female authors, which is not the case in many other countries. So I think if we compare, I don't have the data, but if we compare to other countries, I'm sure there will be much less women. Diversity and the growing interest in non-Western cultures characterized the period called globalization. The globalization process started, in fact, earlier after the Second World War with the GATT agreements adopted in 1947. Promoted by the United States, this process accelerated in the 1980s, favored by the neoliberal turn of the 1970s, which saw the abandonment of the theme of development in favor of globalization, as Emmanuel Wallerstein explains. Indeed, this notion of globalization also expressed the growing inclusion of non-Western countries in this market with the support of political organizations such as UNESCO, as we saw. The negotiation initiated in 1986 in the Uruguay cycle focused on the extension of the Uruguay round, focused on the extension of the liberalization of exchanges to the trade in services, GATS, which include immaterial or intangible goods, especially cultural products. The debate was primarily centered around the question of audiovisual media that the American delegation wanted to include on the list of products subjected to free trade. This implied the abandonment of systems of financial support for national productions. This demand by the American elicited a lively reaction in countries like France, driving the European Parliament to adopt in 1992 a rallying resolution in the name of cultural exception, as you probably recall, according to which cultural goods are not like any other merchandise, and therefore they must benefit from a special status which gives this product the right to receive public funding. Criticized for being defensive, protectionist, elitist, and Eurocentric, because the resolution privileged the protection of cultural works recognized by Western tradition to the detriment of other national and regional cultures, the notion of cultural exception was replaced under the auspices of UNESCO by the term cultural diversity, which is connected to a whole system of values and practices from different societies according to the anthropological definition of the notion of culture. UNESCO's Universal Declaration on Cultural Diversity, adopted in 2001, stipulates that cultural diversity, a factor of development, notably economic, quote, constitute the common patrimony of humanity. Denying the capacity of market forces to preserve cultural diversity, the declaration claims the recognition of the specificity of cultural goods and services because they are bearers, quote, of identity, values, and meanings, and they therefore must not be considered like other merchandise. The declaration gave rise in 2005 to the Convention on Cultural Diversity, aiming to harmonize the measures on the protection of cultural goods and services at the international level. Though literature was not directly concerned by these agreements, the dynamics of globalization favored the intensification of translation in the world. The number of translations rose plus 50% between 1980 and 2000. The emergence of multinational corporations in the book market contribute to the unification of this global market. Literary agents also play a prominent role in this unification. Nevertheless, the national classification of literary works continue with genre to be a performative category of perception at the pole small-scale circulation of the transnational literary field. I'm using here Bourdieu's distinction between pole of small-scale and large-scale circulation. The large-scale would be the mass market. One still speaks of, as already said, French literature, German literature, Italian literature, Chinese literature, and this reflects the historical importance of the national identities in the emergence and structuring of the transnational literary field. These categories were an obstacle for, as we saw, minorities to gain attention in this field, also because they were marginalized in the national fields. Finally, literary festivals have become, since the 1990s, cosmopolitan literary gatherings. However, since they depend partly on the power relations in the book market, authors invited to international festivals are mostly published by Western publishers. I mean, the most important festivals, because you can find festivals in Africa or in more peripheral regions. So, conclusion. As I have tried to show, the national is not systematically at odds with the international, the transnational, the supranational, nor the cosmopolitan. In all these cases, it depends on the way identity is defined. We can distinguish here more or less essentialist identities to the conceptions of from the conceptions of identities of identity as multiple, as a product of socialization, and as susceptible to evolve, especially thanks to intercultural encounters. While the essentialists regard such encounters as a threat to her or his identity, and we can hear now on the radio in France a lot of people defending, thinking they have to defend French identity against the refugees, including young people. This is the new thing, you know, voting Front National. Those who have an open conception of identity see these encounters as an arrangement of their self and of their own culture. This could be defined as a cosmopolitan attitude, which is relevant to literature. The second conclusion is that the ideology of globalization, cosmopolitanism, and cultural mestizaje should not conceal the unequal power relations between writers regarding the conditions of access to writing and publishing. This is all the more true for writers in peripheral countries who need to be published or translated in the central places by publishers endowed with a high amount of symbolic capital in order to gain visibility in the transnational literary field. And the third conclusion regards Europe. It seems paradoxical that at the very moment when the European literary field opens to non-Western cultures, the European Union closes its borders to immigrants and refugees from this culture. This discrepancy reminds us that the economic and administrative construction of Europe have had no parallel in the intellectual space, in spite of the still vivid memory of a prestigious past and the strong incentives provided by the agencies of the Union. They are regularly called to produce, you know, works on cultural identity, but intellectuals do not mostly respond to that. And this discrepancy also reflects the social gap between elite cosmopolitanism and the international circulation of the dominated in search of work or fleeing war, and whose linguistic skills are demonetized on the European linguistic market, as Emily Apter showed yesterday, as opposed to elite multilingualism, which is considered as a resource on this market. So thanks for your attention.